Killed with a drug overdose, then cut up and put in a wheelie bin. That is what prosecutors allege Cherie Glastonbury did to her partner, 55-year-old Geoffrey McLean. On the case of the wheelie bin murder, we'll follow the murder trial of Cherie Glastonbury and three co-accused as they defend charges relating to Geoffrey's death. Search for the Case Law podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts to make sure you don't miss an episode.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Tony Tan grew up by his mother's side, where, like a little sponge, he absorbed all the flavors, tips, and wisdom she'd picked up as a cook in the colonial kitchens of pre-independence Malaysia. His parents had high hopes for him when they sent him to Australia to study, to ascend to the professional class, an immigrant tale as old as time. But when he arrived, he found a world he had no idea about. And from a childhood steeped in Chinese, Indian, Malaysian, and British flavors, he's built a life in Australia as a chef, teacher, and mentor. Hi, Tony.
Hello. How are you?
I'm really, really well. I'm glad to be here with you. Tony, let's start with where your love of food comes from.
It's very easy. It's a lot to do with family. It's a lot to do with tasting things all the time. It's a lot of curiosity because family, especially Chinese families, we are forever talking about food even before the food is finished. So meaning to say that when you're having breakfast, you're already talking about lunch. And when you're having lunch, you're already talking about dinner. And it's just, it's almost like as if that it's an obsession.
Also snacking in between.
And snacking in between.
And so you're sitting around with your family already thinking ahead to the next meal. But what do you actually discuss? Do you discuss like how it's cooked or where you'll go?
All of the above. All because one of the loveliest things that when we are sitting around, because we come from a restaurant-owning family, so meaning to say that, you know, here we are having our chuk or our rice porridge in the morning, and already in the rice porridge, she said, oh, well, that piece of chicken is not really minced finely enough, or there's not enough ginger that's in there. So, you know, the little me would turn around to say, well, what's wrong with the chicken, you know? What's wrong with the ginger? And so, you know, and me always being really very curious about that, those things. And then the family would turn around and just say, oh, whoever that is rearing those chickens are not really giving us the right chicken that day or whatsoever. So that kind of stuff just happens really very, very, very naturally.
Yeah, and you're learning along the way. So you mentioned that you came from a restaurant-owning family, but how did your parents get into working in food?
My father is virtually or was second-generation Chinese Malayan at that time. And because we were amongst the very last lot of Hainanese people to sort of arrive to the Hainan area, meaning to Malaya and Singapore, it was easier for them to virtually sort of work for the Brits rather than all the other jobs because, I mean, the Cantonese would have taken up being tin miners, or the Hakkas were being tin miners or rubber tappers or running all those kinds of fields. So the Hainanese people were, because they were the last to arrive, they were the ones who were given jobs to be working as cooks, as well as housekeepers, houseboys, anything that is in relation with food, this is how it all happened. So it was just a very natural progression.
And what about your mom?
Mom was virtually a child bride, so to say. She married my father when she was really very young. She was the village beauty, so to say. And so when she married my father, it just meant that she had to listen to what her husband would tell her. And so she ended up working as a cook for the British.
Did she have much cooking experience before then?
I really wish I would know about that. But obviously, being Chinese, there's always that obsession or that really interest and curiosity about food. She was also an orphan. meaning to say that her mother died when she was really very young. In fact, I think it was during childbirth. And so it just meant that, you know, she was being taken care of by aunts and so on. And so, you know, she virtually was being taught how to cook, obviously, you know, from a sort of natural progression sort of thing. And I think it's also a lot to do with her being very, very curious about food. And so that's how she ended up working for the Brits or the colonials as a cook.
Mm. What were some of the cooking lessons that she absorbed in those colonial kitchens?
Interesting. Very interesting question. You know, I was just thinking about something that was really very funny. She had a teacher, so to say, one of the wives of the colonial master or whatsoever. And she was called Bo Ang, and because she had red hair. And so it just meant that she was told how to make rice pudding. She was taught how to make all kinds of stuff, like trifles to roasts and just about anything that is connected to the old country, so to say. So she was learning all that kind of thing. And obviously for her, who's never done all that kind of stuff before, you know, she was like a sponge, so to say. And then she just kept learning as it went along. But knowing her and her curiosity about food, she always added a little bit of something extra. So this is why, you know, her roast chicken became her legendary roast chicken, which meant that she virtually sort of added a little bit of soy sauce to the Worcestershire sauce to make it a little bit different and obviously a little bit more acceptable to her own palate. Gosh.
I've made that roast chicken. It is very delicious.
Did you?
Yeah, and then my cat stole a piece off the table. So there's a vote from the cat as well. Is that the dish of hers that you remember most clearly?
Yes, that's because I think I must have been at least between 3 and 5 years old. So I was really very small. I got images of the roast chickens that she used to make for, you know, the guests upstairs, you know. So it was a little bit like an upstairs-downstairs sort of situation. And so there were several pieces of roast chicken that was being cut up already and being served upstairs. And obviously, you know, there's a carcass that's left behind. And me being so small at that time, I can still run my little finger right through the spine and picking up those pieces of meat. And they were absolutely delicious.
That memory sounds like it's so vivid to you. Do you have other strong memories of her working in the kitchen?
Yes, very much so. I can see her virtually sort of doing things like peeling potatoes, which seemed to me like a ton of them. I can also see in my mind, in fact, I was only thinking about her the other day because she made the creamiest rice pudding I've ever eaten in my life. And I've been trying so hard to duplicate that and I can't. And it drives me crazy because I don't really quite know why her rice pudding is so creamy and so luscious instead of that really what I call a stodgy rice pudding. So that's one of those really very strong memories that I have of her.
And you grew up in Kuantan in the east of Malaysia.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of a child were you back then?
I think I was a very precocious child. I was also relatively smart in school. I think I was also really very curious about food all the time. And it was like going to the school, coming home, doing what my parents expected of me, sitting by the counter, while all I really wanted to do was just to go out and play. But, you know, it's not one of those things that happens.
Tony, did you have a nickname?
Yes, because like I said, you know, I'm really very curious. I really wanted to know things very, very quickly. My neighbors would tease me. And so because I would be forever asking, what's in the cup of tea? What's in that water? Why is that water so really very special? Until they got a little bit sick of me and they turn around and just say, You're like a little chili, aren't you? Meaning to say that you're fast, you're hot, you're very quick in learning things. So they used to call me La Chuchai, meaning to say little chili.
Yeah.
So that's how it stuck. And everybody used to start calling me little chili. And I answered to that, isn't that stupid?
I think it's adorable. What did your parents expect of you?
They knew that I would do well at school. They also wanted me to be a professional. They wanted me to be proud of what I've achieved. So that's the general expectation. And they also really wanted me to not be involved in a restaurant and not be going to study in a hotel school, so to say, because my father had a hotel and he was known as a hotel king. That's during the late 50s and early 60s.
Why?
So it's because the hours are very long, and it's also a lot to do with, you know, you've got to be out there servicing customers and their needs all the time. And it's also really very, very, very long, long hours whereby you turn around and just say that, you know, you're very tired and they're still sitting there drinking their beer at 12 o'clock and all you really want to do is just go back to sleep. That's the reason why.
In 1976, you finish high school, your family sends you to Melbourne to study. Had you ever been away from home before?
No. I mean, in a complete sense, definitely not, yes. But I would make trips to Kuala Lumpur and so on and to Singapore, but nothing of that nature.
Well, this is different. You're changing countries. You're going by yourself.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what was that feeling like?
Excited, curious. You can see that it's a new adventure that's happening. You don't really quite know what lies ahead. But on the other hand, I mean, you arrive into a new country and you really want to know as much of the new country as much as possible.
And what did you think would happen? What kind of path would you travel?
I thought I would follow the most natural path, meaning to say that, you know, like all good Asian kids, you come here, you finish university, you go home, then you work, and the family is really very proud of you, and you end up happily ever after. But it wasn't that path for me. It was least expected.
Something quite different happened instead.
Yes.
Where did you stay when you arrived in Melbourne?
I was staying over in Croydon, mm-hmm. and it was a long way away from the action, so to say. Back in the 70s, I can still remember that I really wanted to go into the Croydon market and looking for coriander. And they all told me that I've got to go to a health food shop to go and look for coriander seeds. And I said, no, I mean fresh coriander. And I can remember very distinctly that I was dispatched very, very nicely and said, you've got to go down to Chinatown, mate.
What was the food in Melbourne like at that time?
There's only one word to describe it. Interesting.
What was interesting?
It was really very, there was a certain curiosity, except that the kind of curiosity wasn't confined to the outer, to the suburbs. It was really very much based around, the most interesting food is to go down to Chinatown or down to your regular Chinese restaurant and you look for your sweet and sour pork, you look for your lemon chicken, you look for your fried rice. You just don't go anything beyond that. You have to come into the city to go and look for something that's a little bit more exotic, so to say, like looking for Greek food, looking for French, you know, and so on.
And what were you enrolled to study at that time?
I was meant to be studying law. I was meant to be doing professional subjects like architecture, accountancy, all those kind of things. But what I did was that went out of the window very quickly because I caught up with some friends who were hippie friends then, And so they said, well, why don't you come down and be a dishwasher? And I jumped at that opportunity to be a dishwasher working in a vegetarian restaurant.
Tony, what did you think the first time you visited Lygon Street, which is the Little Italy of Melbourne?
It was a very exhilarating experience. It was like, my goodness, what's happening here? You see the Hare Krishna people that's, you know, sort of playing their drums, you know, and you just wonder why is it that they are Caucasian people that are walking around in Indian saris and, you know, having all that dots on their head and, you know, and the hair that's being tied back like little bundles and all that sort of stuff. And you just wonder why is it that they are sort of playing the cymbals and all that. And you just wonder why is it that it is possible for people to be walking down the street smelling of different kinds of cigarettes rather than the kind of legal cigarettes that we know of, you know. And that was a little bit of a shock to the experience, for a boy who's from Kuantan and not really quite knowing that kind of, you know, I was, put it this way, I was really very, very wide-eyed and very, very curious about, it's a completely different experience to what I would have imagined life would be like here in Australia.
Yeah, tell me more about who you were in 1976, freshly landed in Melbourne from Malaysia. You have this expectation for your parents on your shoulders. What does that Tony look like? What is he up to? What is his thinking like?
That Tony was just like transitioning from being a kid, you know, walking into a china shop, so to say, and really wanted to break all those rules. And the little kid was very curious about there is a different life out there, a life whereby, you know, there's a certain freedom, there's a certain, how shall I put it, there is that kind of curious way of living, you know, and that people would be sort of walking around, you know, in very, very unusual clothing, so to say, you know, those kind of tie-dyed stuff and all that kind of thing, you know. So I couldn't believe that that world existed. En masse.
Yeah. And you're studying law and accounting at that time. What happens soon after your studies begin? I mean, you've had this taste of this new life.
I was enrolled into university, and within 3 months, I jumped out of university.
Wow.
Yeah, that's how quick that was.
Right.
Yeah.
Why did you drop out?
Because I was more curious about food than anything else. I really wanted to be a part of what Lygon Street is all about. I was really very curious about what it's like working in a vegetarian restaurant called Shakahari. And it was like, my goodness, there is all this wonderful brown rice dishes that I've never even heard of in my life. I've never even seen things like pomegranates and how do you sort of merge, you know, almonds with tofu and tahini, you know, all those new ingredients which I don't see in Malaysia. I mean, tofu obviously is from there, but, you know, things like tahini, things like pomegranates, things like cashew cream, you know. And then suddenly people would turn around and just say, I'm sorry, but I don't drink dairy. I need almond milk. You know, it was mind-boggling.
Oh, that sounds like now, Tony.
Well, funnily enough, huh? How things transition and now it's totally acceptable.
Absolutely. So you start washing dishes in Shakahari through the recommendation of your Australian hippie friend. Mm-hmm. What kind of clientele were you seeing coming through the doors of that restaurant?
Very interesting ones. Anybody who is really very much into, you know, what I call that kind of hippie look about them, you know, with beads and all that sort of thing, to people who are professionals as well. We've had people who are singers, people who are from the arty world, so to say. And that's when I realized that I belong to that kind of arty world. Oh, what a confession.
What were you being paid for being a dishy there?
$1.25 an hour.
Was that a lot of money?
To me, it was a lot of money then.
Around that time, you moved house, so you could be closer to the restaurant you were working in. How did you find your new accommodation?
I've never lived in a shared household before, so it was really interesting to move into a house whereby there were five or six people sharing a house. It was like I needed to really absorb. Oh, yes, that's something else that that's something that I really need to talk about, and that is I really wanted to understand what Australian culture is all about, particularly that culture whereby living in a house whereby people are really very curious about another person's culture, what it's like to understand why is it that that person is vegetarian, why is it that person is being an academic, why is that person is really very interested in the arts, in music, all that sort of thing.
Around this time, you head over to a friend's house for a visit. Who answered the door and what did this person look like?
Well, I didn't expect somebody who is wearing fry boots, blonde haired, looking at me very quizzically, quite curious, why is it that this Asian Chinese person knocking on the door, trying to work out who am I, and I was trying to sort of work out who he is, and I couldn't believe that, you know, that this guy would invite me into the house because I was looking for a very dear friend of mine called Janine. He invited me in and we had a very long conversation about just about anything to do with life, you know, right from talking about the positive things about drinking tea to understanding Chinese culture. Was very curious about why am I interested in food.
You covered a lot of ground in that conversation, spent a lot of time together. Did you know at that point that Terry was gay?
I didn't know that he was gay, and I was already aware that something is just not quite right about me, put it that way, because, I mean, in Malaysia, you just don't talk about being gay. And so I knew very well that, you know, there was an interesting thing that is beginning to happen to me, not really quite knowing if who I'm attracted to and so on. And I can remember very distinctly that why am I finding this man interesting to talk to? Why am I, you know, drawn to the conversations that he has? And Terry's very, very witty. And so, you know, it was like, And I also know that, you know, my friend Janine is gay. So, you know, and it was that kind of slowly acceptance or curiosity about the change that I'm moving from being a kid who doesn't really quite know his own sexuality to being gay.
So how are you introduced to the gay scene in Melbourne?
Through Terry. I mean, it was already that kind of curiosity that was happening at that time was he was really very interested in catching up with me. He said that, why don't we catch up some other time? And I can remember very distinctly, I went home after having a long conversation with him and he rang me in the house because at that time there was no mobile phones. And he rang me and he said, well, why don't I come over and have a cup of tea with you? And I thought, that's really very interesting. And so he came over and had a cup of tea with me. And then he said, why don't you go out for dinner? And that was when I thought, something is happening and not really quite knowing what's happening. And then he said that let's go out to this very interesting Sri Lankan restaurant. And he was trying to show off to me that he knows a lot about Asian food.
That's sweet.
That's, yes.
Where did he take you?
To a restaurant which doesn't exist anymore, and it's called Taprobane. And that was over in Camberwell. So he was trying to impress on me about, you know, what Sri Lankan food is all about. And it's also because that he's been to Sri Lanka maybe a year or two ago and all that sort of thing. So he was trying to impress me. And he did impress me.
How close was Terry to his family?
Terry was very close to his family. He was really very curious about introducing me to his family. And by which time, you know, his father was, I can remember coming home one day, by which time we started living together as a couple. And so we moved out of the shared house and moved to a two-bedroom house in North Fitzroy as well. I can remember coming home one day and he broke the wall down between the dining room and the living room on his own. And I had such a shock when I saw all the, you know, electrical wires sort of hanging out. And he's already in the meantime called his parents to come over and his brother to come over to help. And so it was, and I remember very distinctly that his father would turn around and just said that this one, meaning me, is very hardworking because I was helping him moving, the family moving bricks and all that sort of stuff. And that's when I realized that I was being told by Terry to meet me with his family.
Yeah, and that you were accepted by them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So a couple of years after you got together, you and Terry take a trip home to Malaysia. Mm-hmm. What did you tell your family about who you're bringing?
I was just bringing a very close friend. That's all I did. Because, I mean, you know, you just don't talk about those kind of things, especially, you know, in Malaysia, and especially when you come from a family whereby, you know, there are very strict family protocols and acceptance in, especially back in the 70s, it was back in 1979, I can remember very distinctly.
And how did your family receive him?
They were curious about him. They were being very polite. They obviously didn't know what was happening. And we stayed for about 2 or 3 weeks. And then afterwards, then we went over to Penang. At that time, we were staying at the ENO, which was meant to be one of the very old but traditional hotels. And at that time, I realized that the both of us were very, very much in love with each other.
That's lovely. Mm. Okay, so Tony, your parents had sent you to Australia with the hopes that you would become a lawyer or accountant or some kind of white-collar professional.
Yes.
But in reality, you were part owner of the restaurant that you'd been working in. How did you break the news to them?
I didn't even break the news to them. All I did was I just went home and said, right, I've got all this money now. I am now, you know, the owner of a restaurant. I am now sharing this glory with two other business partners. And I don't need any money from you at all. And so it was like I've virtually sort of put my stamp down to say that I'm now a professional because I'm now a businessman. I'm capable of running a restaurant. I'm also training to become a chef. And so, you know, that was just, like, tough.
Did they accept that, though?
I think they had trouble accepting, but they had no choice but to accept.
At this stage, your parents are retired?
Mm-hmm.
How are they living their lives in retirement?
With a lot of comfort. My father actually had a stroke, but they were well looked after. They were at a time in their lives whereby they've already moved from the shop house that the family owned to a proper house, so to say. So my mother would virtually sort of grow papayas in the garden. She had mangoes in the garden. Yeah. She would grow snake beans and all that, you know. So, you know, her life was one of comfort, and yet at the same time, she didn't really have to sort of be working nonstop all the time.
Your father suffered a stroke.
Yep.
Were you able to communicate much with him?
Not much, because he was already at that time. My brother was looking after him. And so it just meant that, you know, he was not as well as we were thinking that he would be. In fact, he died 3 years after, no, sorry, or 82, but that's when he died. So it didn't take long.
I'm sorry to hear that. When you and Terry got back to your life in Melbourne, things were changing and you were both thinking about the future. What were you considering?
Right. Terry is a lawyer, and he decided that he also wanted to have a change in his life. And so we, the both of us, gave up our respective businesses. He gave up the law, and I gave up my restaurant. I sold my share to another business partner. And then the both of us embarked on what I called a culinary journey of discovery. So that's the reason why we went over to the UK and to France as well, just to make sure that we are able to sort of do things that the both of us wanted to do, and that is to open our own place. And so, and it was an amazing time for the both of us, because it was a time of discovering what food is all about in the old countries, so to say.
Why did you think Terry, a lawyer, was doing this?
I think it's, to be honest, if I were to look at it quite realistically, I think it's out of love more than anything else. He was really very curious to know what is it about the food world that's so really very exciting, and the food world is still very exciting. So he wanted to be with me. He wanted to sort of have that shared experience about what it's like to be running a restaurant. So he obviously couldn't be the chef in a kitchen. So it was a little bit like Fawlty Towers, so to say.
That's very sweet. I mean, you're both enrolled in a course at La Varenne in Paris.
Yes.
And one day a news crew comes to do some filming. What happened then, Tony?
I didn't really want to be close to Terry, because I knew he was going to be a terrible cook. So he met a lovely girl, an American girl, who was obviously sent over by her parents to really understand a little bit of culture, so to say, particularly food culture, because she was expected to, you know, be somebody when she goes back to America. And so they were both given the role of making the ice cream. And they were both so really very busy talking to each other and all that sort of stuff, too busy having a good time. And they were meant to be churning the ice cream. When the crew came over to look at the ice cream, they opened the lid and there was nothing in there, because the churner wasn't in.
Somebody's got to make the ice cream.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was just sort of slushing around in there. And the ice cream was never even made. It was just awful. And they sort of, I can still see their faces, and they sort of look up, you know, ta-da, that kind of look on their faces. And then they look down in there, and there was just nothing but slush.
Meanwhile,
In the meantime, I just ran away. I just didn't even want to know that he was, you know, with me studying at La Varenne.
He's doing a course because he loves you.
Yes.
And you disavow him the moment he makes a mistake. That's the dynamic.
That's a dynamic.
At what point did you realize, though, that what made you special in the world of cooking came from your Chinese-Malaysian heritage, that is actually what made you stand out and what you could offer?
Okay, so we came back and we opened a restaurant in Sydney called Tatler Cafe. And it was right in front of a cinema. The both of us didn't really quite know what the Sydney scene was all about. All we really wanted to do was to do something that we could both really feel proud of. And so there were things that I introduced back in the 80s, like, how is it possible to use char siu in a salad? you know. And so at that time, it was quite revolutionary because nobody would have thought of making a char siu, Cantonese barbecue pork, and putting that into a salad. So it virtually was meant that, you know, you find whatever salad greens that's available in the market, adding that to your sliced barbecue pork and introducing a dressing to it. And then afterwards, then either putting in some peanuts or putting in some pine nuts in there. And people would turn around and just say, wow, this is so unusual, especially when you're eating with homemade bread. So I was making my own bread rolls. And then imagine having a little bit of that barbecue pork with a salad green that is a French salad. So in other words, there are things like cos lettuces, there are things like oak leaf lettuce, you know. So it was a little bit unusual. And then when we were also making things like terrines that I learned in France, and then I introduced and put in a little bit of a chutney on top of that. But the chutney had five spices in there. The chutney had star anise in there. So it was already quite unusual from that perspective. I was also making things like pasta, you know, just regular pasta, but already throwing things that are took different kinds of seafood that's in there. So be it if it is going to be prawns or calamari or whatever, but then throwing things a little bit like oyster sauce into that pasta. But nobody knew that there was oyster sauce that was in there. All they know was it was a little bit unusual. So it goes back to my mother, you know, who really wanted to introduce things like soy sauce into a roast chicken. But unconsciously, I was doing it because I really wanted to make something that tasted nice, but I could identify with without really feeling that I was doing something that was naughty or unusual. Because it was just like understanding the two flavors that worked together, but yet at the same time, it actually worked in harmony, or there was a balance that's there.
Tony, in the intervening years, you've had your own restaurant. You've written cookbooks, you've been on TV, you started your own cooking school. And then in amongst all this, you led gastronomic tours all around the world. Can you tell me a story that stands out to you from one of those trips?
So one of my first tours that I was asked to do was to do a tour to Malaysia. So that was really very interesting because, I mean, also really relatively easy because, you know, I know Malaysia with my eyes closed, so to say, because I, you know, there are those three really very powerful cultures, Chinese, Malay, and Indian, you know, so that meaning to say that one day they'll be eating nasi lemak, the next day they'll be eating roti canai, and then afterwards, then they would end up having, you know, a duck that is cooked in a mud brick oven, you know, and so on. So that was really very easy. It was also during that period whereby a lot of people were really very curious about what's happening in Asia because that was back in the 1990s, you know, and that's well and truly during that period, that was, I call the flowering of food here in Australia. You know, we had so many wonderful, wonderful chefs and fantastic food writers like Stephanie Alexander and so on. And there were two really very interesting things that happened. One of them was I didn't know that there were people who were really very curious about another culture. People were really very interested in knowing about what it's like to know other young people from a different culture. And so there was this very unusual experience, which I can still remember as clear as day. There was this single lady that went on the trip. And so she ended up having an affair with the guide, the local tour guide. It was really very embarrassing because we were meant to be traveling from mainland Malaysia, or peninsula Malaysia, to Sarawak and, you know, East Malaysia. And we were desperately, because we were about to get on the plane, and so we were looking for her everywhere. And she came very just in the nick of time with the guide, hair ruffled, and trying to sort of work out as though that, you know, nothing happened. And we all knew what was happening. None of us could possibly say anything because, you know, it it's a gourmet tour. And it was just shocking.
You can't say that on a gourmet tour.
Exactly. And then there was another one, a lady who was sent by her husband because obviously, you know, he wanted to make sure that she was having a very good time away from domestics, so to say. So she enrolled on the tour. And one of the first things that she said was, "I hate rice on a tour to Asia." Not a bad line, huh? So I looked at her very diplomatically and said, "Madam, we can always have noodles."
So diplomatic.
Yes.
Yes.
What else could you possibly do?
The face betrays nothing.
Yes, the face betrays nothing.
Drawing on those hospitality skills intergenerationally inherited from your
exactly.
father.
Exactly. This is what you have to do.
The customer is always right.
The customer is always, always right.
Tell me about the woman who'd been planning on taking her husband on one of your tours to Vietnam.
Unfortunately, he died before the tour happened. So you know what she did? She took her husband's ashes with her on the tour to Vietnam. And she would be talking about him. So we all knew that she really wanted to share her journey with her husband on that gourmet tour. And they would be talking about it when she went to bed. And that's something that I'll remember for as long as I live.
Of course.
And it made me feel really very good inside that I knew that I have made her trip memorable.
Mm. These days, you find yourself in regional Victoria, in Trentham. Tell me about some of the gastronomic delights or surprises that Trentham offers.
Trentham is unique. It is a little town or village that I never really expected it's going to be so wonderful. I have discovered that there are people that are growing potatoes. In fact, it's known as one of the best regions in Victoria that produces amazing potatoes. So this is why it has the Spud Fest every May. It's also a region whereby they grow a lot of truffles. So it's also really very unusual because, I mean, how is it possible that, you know, in a little town like Trentham, that there are a couple of truffle farms that are close by? There is also somebody who is growing saffron.
And after so many decades in Melbourne, what stood out to you moving to the country?
In the sense that it helped me to find myself again. And it makes me think along the lines that, you know, there is always a connection with food growing and then producing that kind of stuff and putting it on the table, whereby, you know, it makes me appreciate nature all the more. It makes me understand what it's like to have my own eggs from my own chickens, you know. It makes me think about my mother, all those things.
How does it make you think about your mother?
Because she's one of those amazing women who is really very interested in growing her own things. She was really very interested in making sure that the eggs that she gets from her chooks would virtually sort of turn into the most beautiful fried egg on fried rice, on toast. And that she made the most beautiful Chinese-style chawan mushi.
Steamed egg.
Yes, steamed egg. And that's fantastic. Mm. And I love that so much. And she would be able to sort of throw things on top of it, which even makes the steamed egg even more beautiful.
If you could speak to her and tell her about your life now, what would you want to tell her?
And that is, I hope she's proud of me. And that I love her very dearly, still.
Tony, as you've said, your mom is no longer with us. You've made food your life, and you're still leading cooking classes from your home in Trentham. What did her early education teach you beyond ingredients and techniques?
Making food my life is about sharing. It's about sharing knowledge. You don't hold back. You have to be really very committed to what you are doing. You have to be very passionate, which I hope that the listener out there can feel the passion, because food is about giving. If the moment when you stop giving and you hoard things, particularly in terms of knowledge, that's when you stop living as a human being. That's my take on where I'm at.
Mm. Did you ever expect this would be the life that you lived when you were a little boy running your little pinky fingers in the chicken carcasses?
No, never. But maybe it's because the gods up there didn't really want to tell me until I'm much older and a little bit wiser.
You've made huge contributions through your work to Australian food. What are you most proud of?
To be able to sort of cross cultures, because I tend to think that we here in Australia particularly, we are a country whereby we are very, very interested in other people. And for me, obviously through food, I'm able to sort of bridge that gap. And this is something that I'm really very proud of.
Tony, thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations today.
Beverly, I have to say that it's been a total privilege. Thank you so very, very much for having me.
My guest today was chef, author, and cooking teacher Tony Tan. Today's episode was recorded on the lands of the Kulin Nation. It was produced by Alice Moldovan. Nicola Harrison is the executive producer. I'm Beverly Wang. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.